And so to me, the number one thing I would say to anybody who's an American is you need to get religion on crypto being allowed. You don't have to like it. You don't have to think it's great. You don't have to think it's perfect. But the idea that just banning it will work will only cause us to play from behind in the future of the financial system. And that's a huge mistake.
Welcome to the Dark Markets Podcast, your guide to the shadowy depths of finance, tech, and crypto. I'm reporter and historian David Z. Morris. Back in 2013, I became one of the first journalists to cover cryptocurrency in a mainstream publication. As a reporter for outlets like Fortune Magazine and CoinDesk, I've helped expose and bring down fraudsters like Nikola Motor CEO Trevor Milton, Luna creator Do Kwon, and FTX mastermind Sam Bankman-Fried. My guest today is Austin Campbell, founder of Zero Knowledge Consulting. Austin is a veteran money manager and an adjunct professor at Columbia Business School, with stints at Citi and JP Morgan, where he specialized in global risk, stable value, and insurance products. Austin then brought his TradFi bona fides over to crypto, managing risk and portfolio for the stablecoin issuer Paxos. His insider view has made him an insightful crypto commentator. Above all, in his nuanced criticisms of how Gary Gensler's SEC has failed to properly regulate the emerging sector. Austin and I talked about his transition from TradFi to crypto, the misguided U.S. crypto crackdown, Gensler's short-sighted and self-interested track record as a regulator, and Austin's encounter with the FTX crew. Please welcome Austin Campbell to Dark Markets. Welcome, Austin Campbell, to Dark Markets, the podcast about crypto and other things. I still have to work on my elevator pitch, but welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Austin is I don't know if there's one word to describe you, but veteran banker for sure. But I don't know if you would even call it banking. You're in a different place in the organization, but you have recently started really getting more involved in crypto, not recently, but a couple of years. So first of all, welcome. Tell us about yourself and kind of what you do and what you've done.
Yeah, I mean, so part of the reason you're having trouble describing my career is that it a little bit defies description, right? Like I jokingly once said at a party, my whole shtick is chasing interesting problems around and trying to get people to pay me for it. So I started way back in the day on reinsurance, actually, because a timely topic in the early to mid 2000s was modeling terrorism risk, which coincidentally, the form of math I had been studying was how you did that at the time. So I broke in there, and that slowly had this gravitational pull towards securities markets because I started with traditional reinsurance and then catastrophe bonds and then thinking about trading those bonds. So I ended up at JP Morgan. Right, as you're referring to the banker background. Mm-hmm. And I was part of and then ran insurance-linked trading over a span of about a decade. And that's a little bit of a misnomer because at JP Morgan, inside of insurance-linked trading was all the cash stability products. So if you're a crypto person, I'm about to say something and you think you know what I'm talking about, but it's not true. And so what it is it's a product where we would have a large underlying portfolio of bonds, and then people would need to be able to trade in and out of that portfolio at a stable $1 value, right? If you say that to people in crypto, they think you're talking about a stable coin. But in reality, there's a thing called stable value. It's been around for many, many decades in traditional markets. There's roughly $1 trillion of it in 401ks and other retirement products. I ran that desk at JP Morgan, among other things, which is part of what eventually led me towards crypto.
And is that basically kind of constantly rebalancing a portfolio?
So if you want to get into the nitty gritty on that one, what you're doing is looking at a retirement fund and say, well, if we want a cash preservation product in here, the off-the-shelf version is a money market fund. But putting that kind of liquidity into your 401k is a little bit like killing an ant with a bazooka. right? Which is to say, it'll do the job, but there's going to be some collateral damage. So what you instead do is take something that looks like your average investment grade short-term bond fund. So think of thousands of CUSIPs, you know, duration of 2 to 3 to 4 years, spread across industry sectors, gotcha, security types. So like there's a mix of a lot of stuff. So there's ABS, MBS, CMBS, commercial credit, sometimes govies, munis, less so because of the tax reasons. You take all of that, you sell something called a wrap derivative. And the way that derivative works is to say, hey, if all of your participants come and take their money out, you liquidate everything and there's not enough to pay them back at that stable value, I'll cover the gap.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right. So it's literal bailout insurance in that case. Yeah. And so this is a product that exists and worked, in fact, through the financial crisis quite well.
Can I ask one dumb question before we move on?
Tell me.
What you're describing, how is that different from actually running a money market fund?
So in a money market fund, you have no explicit guarantee and you need to provide way more liquidity. So in money market world, these are demand deposits that people could withdraw at any time and there's really no frictional barrier to doing so, right? So if I'm at Fidelity, for instance, and I'm running the government money market fund there, I'm kind of always planning for Armageddon in some ways, which is to say I've got a weighted average duration of 30 days. And I've got to have huge cash.
You have to be able to get everybody out at the same time.
Yes. Whereas in stable value, if everybody cashes out of their 401k simultaneously, like we've got much bigger problems than what's going on locally with that fund. That's like a collapse of the financial system because there's a huge tax penalty associated with that. So different dynamics.
So you did that for 10 years. And I don't know if you made the pivot to crypto after that, or was there something else?
Somewhat accidentally. So while I was at JPM, I had been thinking a lot about fixed income settlement and started reading a little bit about crypto, but I'm not going to lie. My interest there was purely academic and kind of casual. In 2018, I got to a company called Stone Ridge, where I was hired nominally to be a reinsurance portfolio manager there, you know, back to the whole insurance thing. But Stone Ridge is NYDIG's parent. And so early on in my tenure, one of the lawyers at Stone Ridge came over to me and was like, hey, we've been told you know a lot about lending. And I'm like, some, probably more than most people at Stone Ridge at the time, especially structured lending. And they said to me, well, if I wanted to lend money against Bitcoin, could I do that? And I'm like, I mean, that seems easy. It's just an asset. And they're like, but with a bank. And I'm like, okay, now this is interesting.
Yeah.
And so I helped them put together some of the structures for early, like cash secured repo against Bitcoin style trades, very sharp people over there trying to get things right legally and structurally to make sure you were like, you know, fulfilling all the regulatory obligations. NYDIG, for those who don't know, is one of the companies under the NYDFS aegis. And so I did that for about 2.5 years while I was there. Then I was at Citi, where I was the co-head of digital assets and global rates. We were looking at starting a crypto lending business. That's where I first encountered our friends over at FTX. And then after that, I was at Paxos, where I ran the stablecoin platform for about a year, was the CRO of one of our financial entities we were booting up. And so basically, I've been kicking around in crypto one way or another, more on the, call it, pseudo financial side as opposed to the deep degen side for like close to 6 years now.
Yeah. And you know, stop me if I'm incorrect, but my understanding is that things wrapped up at Paxos because of an SEC judgment that they lost, right?
Well, I mean, not for me personally. And I would say, I don't think the SEC was the problem that Paxos was facing. So when you're talking about the whole situation around BUSD, which is, I think, where you're going,
right?
This is an important thing to remember. Paxos is NYDFS regulated, and the DFS is essentially a banking style regulator. Most of their concerns around BUSD had to do with the commercial partnership with Binance.
And is it not the SEC at all? Did I get that wrong?
So the SEC sent a Wells notice at the same time to pile on, but I can tell you that was not causal to what happened.
Gotcha. So sorry, I interrupted you. Say that again. What was the concern you thought from DFS?
So when you had BUSD, the DFS historically requires approval for you to issue on any chain, and they had only approved BUSD for Ethereum. So the DFS licensed Ethereum that Paxos was doing was only on mainnet, right? Binance found this super annoying. And I'm going to say some of their concerns were legitimate, which is to say other people would then start bridging BUSD to other chains, often in very janky ways. So Binance said, okay, well, if this is happening, we should just do it ourselves. And so they did. So they were bridging BUSD to BNB, to FTM, to all sorts of other chains.
Oh, okay. You can't do that, buddy.
Well, you can, but you have to represent it clearly, make sure that you can show you're not printing money, and not claim that the BUSD on those other chains has the same legal rights as the BUSD on ETH. I think if Binance had said, listen, this is privately bridged, the token on the BNB chain does not have the legal rights of the Ethereum chain, only the technological rights. So if you want to redeem it, you've got to bridge it back. And that's when you're in NYDFS world again. They might have been okay, but they didn't do that. They were very poor at the discussion and, you know, sort of representations around it. And I want to be clear. I don't think that's out of malice. I think that's out of disorganization.
Yeah. I remember at the time the discussion about BUSD like launching on all of these chains, which is obviously in retrospect not what was actually happening and is perhaps the problem.
Precisely. If they had said we are launching wrapped BUSD on all of these chains, and I would have advised Binance name it something other than just BUSD.
Yeah.
Right. You know, you've got BETH. You may want to name this like BBUSD or something like that so that people know it's wrapped through the Binance platform. I think they would have been in much better shape. I also think, to be honest, U.S. regulators, as we've witnessed, have a certain degree of animus towards Binance in general that was informing this. And so BUSD was shut down. But I would tell you, I don't think the SEC had anything to do with that. I think they were just being opportunistic and piling on.
In fact, if anything, it's so interesting to hear, and, you know, I'm not in the weeds on the details of all of this, but it's so interesting to hear that DFS had licensed Paxos to issue this stablecoin, like specifically, like I didn't even know that was a thing. That's which is to say that, like, you know, DFS is actually like out there involved in getting these things set up in a way that makes sense and works and is like under supervision, whereas the SEC is just like Coinbase is illegal, I guess is their stance.
Yeah. So if you want to look at a crypto regulator and one that I think has done a decently adequate job in the United States, I would tell you start with the NYDFS.
Yeah.
I know they've caught a lot of flack for the BitLicense. And I'll tell you right now, nobody thought it was perfect. I knew two of the guys who helped write it at Stone Ridge, including Ben Losky. And I think they would tell you they were making a best efforts attempt to try to bring some regulatory clarity that brought in things like consumer protection and transparency and proper conduct to the crypto space in 2014, which was pretty early on.
Right. That was my next question, was remind us of the date, right? And I was thinking 2016, 2014 is even crazier.
Yeah, no, it started pretty early. And then, so the NYDFS licensed their first stable coins in 2018, and that was USDP and GUSD. And subsequent to that, they have also licensed the GMO stablecoins. So GMO Trust, which is a subsidiary of a giant Japanese company, has two stablecoins that they're experimenting with there. And then also under there was BUSD. You know, so that ecosystem has been around for a while. And here are some important details and why I say I think these guys have done at least an adequate job regulatorily in this space. One, to the best of my knowledge, no NYDFS regulated stablecoin has ever had severe PEG issues. They are very conservative with the reserve guidelines. They make people be very transparent. They do go and examine those companies annually to make sure they are doing the right thing.
That almost sounds proactive.
Yeah, without putting it into any lending platform, because we'll come back to that. But if you just bought any of USDP, GUSD, or BUSD and just left it in your wallet, you've never lost a penny.
Yeah.
Right. These have actually been stable coins. The second part is they've been iterating on guidelines. So while I was at Paxos in 2022, there were several people at the DFS working on revising their stablecoin guidance to make sure that it was up to snuff and best in class. And I was advising them on that. And I think, again, they've done a very good job with it. A lot of McHenry's stablecoin bill actually looks very similar to what the DFS is already doing. So it can be done if you want to make the effort.
So you mentioned something that I want to get to before we move on to our main topic, which is the SEC. You mentioned that you were interacting with FTX at a certain point, and I have to ask for some more detail there.
Yeah, so I cannot say too much there other than to say, when I was at Citi, we were looking at starting a secured lending against crypto business. So I would suggest this is the correct way to lend against crypto assets if you're a regulated financial institution, which is to say, I want a giant pool of collateral. I want liquidation rights to that collateral. And I want a system where that can be executed very quickly because crypto is 24/7. And then in return,
I know you're in the wrong business for me to say this, but that sounds an awful lot like a DeFi system, but continue.
Okay. So we'll come back to that. I have thoughts on that. Not all DeFi is created equal. But in that context, the advantage a bank will have compared to something like a DeFi protocol is your funding rate. Banks fund very cheaply compared to many of these things. So we can lend at decently attractive rates at size, but for very conservative loans. And so in that process, we started talking to people across the industry. We talked to my old colleagues at NYDIG. We were talking to a bunch of the exchanges. We were talking to some of the prime brokers, like everybody. And FTX was one of them. And I remember it was a strange experience because at first we encountered the folks at LedgerX. And they were very buttoned down, had their act together. I remember Mark Wiegand in particular made a very positive impression, like clearly knew his stuff. That little like box was fine. And then we got upstream to the FTX box. And I remember it was just a very weird call where you ask them questions and they're basically like, oh, we don't tell people that. And I'm like, okay, I asked, do you have a market risk program and how does it work? And your answer is, you're not going to tell me. Or like, what are your cold storage procedures? Are they written down? Can you send them to me? Well, we don't really like to talk about that. And it was just a lot of evasion. Right.
That's so crazy, especially on the market risk thing, which we actually know what was involved there now.
Right. So my take on it walking away was just we can't really do business with them because these are all bright line items. We need to know what they are. And other people are telling us and have procedures. I'm going to be transparent and say I didn't think it was a fraud. I thought this was probably just a bunch of like mid-20s people who didn't know what they were doing, kind of running a like shoebox held together with, you know, gum and string, you know, rather than like actually a literal criminal enterprise. But
I you know, that's still the sort of philosophical question, I guess, is like with everything, you know, where did the fraud start? Where did the good intentions run up against reality in such a way that things got completely out of control? I mean, I, you know, personally, I believe that there is fraud in Sam Bankman-Fried's heart of hearts. And I think that just found an opportunity to get out. But it's definitely, you know, the goofiness came first and the fraud came later, I think is definitely correct.
So speaking bluntly on that one, I think it's important to remember with these organizations, there's a lot of moving parts. My best analysis of FTX is it looks similar to some other traditional financial frauds. Which is to say, I think there were probably many people working there who did not know it was a fraud and were honestly doing their job.
Oh yeah.
I think the inner circle around Sam knew that things were very, very wrong and that there was fraud going on. And in fact, cracked down on the people asking questions or trying to expose it. And that given the level of misdeeds, things like just transparently saying in public, your consumer funds are not rehypothecated, they shall not be lent out, these are the property of the exchange, and then doing exactly the opposite on the back end and lying about it is a degree of deliberate malice. Like, that was not an accident.
Definitely not. You know, I mean, this is like the frankly fairly famous column that I wrote at the time, which was like before he was arrested. Like, this was not an accident. Well, anyway, we could talk forever about FTX, but talk a little bit about what you're doing now, because you've gone through, you've kind of gotten your crypto credentials really locked in, and you're kind of doing this for more people now.
Yeah. So what I am doing now is after I left Paxos, I've been teaching a little bit on the side, and that relates to what I'm doing for like work, as I say, which is I started my own advisory firm. And the idea behind it is I think a lot of the gaps in the crypto space right now are around communication between people who have financial and risk management knowledge and people who have knowledge of the technology, right? That crypto is a multidisciplinary effort. And if we're being totally honest with each other, the bankers have been arrogant and told the tech people that they don't understand what they're doing and this is all a scam and it's stupid. See the comments of my former like boss, Jamie Dimon on that front. But on the other hand, equally so from the other side, the tech people have been extremely arrogant, basically told the finance people, you don't have any useful knowledge either. The reality is both of them are wrong, right? Both sides have valuable inputs. And so I'm here trying to help people bridge that gap from both sides. So I help people in the crypto space understand risk, ecosystem building, business models, the kinds of things they're going to need to do to interact with corporations or, God knows, like really institutional banks and things like that occasionally. On the other hand, I help a lot of corporates and banks figure out, how do I approach crypto safely? What can I do? What can I not do? What parts of this work? What parts of this don't work? What do I need to know? So, you know, my job is essentially helping often senior executives, because they have teams under them telling them things that they don't know what to believe. Right. So it helps to have somebody who's only paid, like, to be honest, telling them what's going on, sort these issues out, build the right things, don't waste time building the wrong things, and find the pathways that actually work.
Yeah. And have you, I guess, like, from the inside, is your general sense that, you know, over the last year or so, I mean, I guess you left Paxos after 2022?
End of 2022. That is
end of 2022. So, you know, that was the year of the terror. And so I guess I'm curious, over the past year, have you seen people kind of recovering from the shock and horror of what happened in 2022 to kind of open their mind again about the broader trend?
I mean, I think some of that is actually understanding why things went so wrong in 2022.
Right.
And if you really like look deeply at it, it exposes what are the good parts and the bad parts of the ecosystem and like how do things really work. I would tell you in general, I think there are a lot of people who are still very optimistic long term about the technology. I think those people are often also extremely pessimistic about many of the things that have currently been built so far, which is not an indictment on the future path, right, of the space. In many ways, I look at 2022 in crypto a little bit like the tech crash around 2000, mm-hmm. which is to say, a lot of things before then got wiped out, but that did not stop us from using the internet or technology, right? Like it may be more of an execution problem than it is like a core technological problem.
Yeah. And I just like, I don't know how much you are engaged in this level of discussion with people, but I mean, I feel like things have turned around in a crazy way. Like two things off the top of my head, obviously ordinals and other innovations on Bitcoin are going to be crazy. People are building L2s on Bitcoin now in a real way that is just like wild. And then I don't know if you've probably seen me tweeting a lot about Farcaster, which I'm super stoked about, too, which is not, you know, necessarily like the kind of thing you deal with directly. But it's certainly like I feel like it's a really nice model for where things can go. And it's like, you know, we've had like multiple decentralized social media scams. And so to have one that doesn't seem to be a scam and is not asking people to pay $5,000 up front for their namespace is nice.
So it's interesting to me that people raise things like this as examples, because I look at the space and I say, I'll come back to Farcaster, but let's talk specifically about Bitcoin for a moment. I am actually pretty skeptical about many of the Bitcoin L2s. And I think it has to do with how I think about financial markets in general, which is I've always been anti-monolithic chains. Mm. I've always been like, call it anti-generalist, because the reality is transaction preferences themselves are not monolithic. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I hit my class with occasionally at Columbia when they ask questions like this is, well, do you think you need the same amount of security to buy a $5 coffee and clear a $5 billion repo trade?
Yeah.
Because if the answer is no, then you're probably talking about a non-monolithic blockchain world. I think Bitcoin has proven, my opinion, that it's a pretty good store of value in terms of the design, mm-hmm. and that it's a relatively secure like storage and custody layer. So in many ways, when I analogize it to digital gold, I mean that as a compliment. Like it's really hard to be gold.
Yeah.
Many things have wanted to dethrone gold and none of them have succeeded so far. So the fact that Bitcoin might is actually quite the compliment. But on the other hand, I don't think Bitcoin is ever going to be a fast payment system, because there are many things you need built in there, like high-speed batching, transaction reconciliation, chargebacks, like reversals. And all of those are antithetical to the design of Bitcoin and would actually greatly undermine it. And if you start building L2s on Bitcoin to do that, it's always kind of a hack. And like, why are you putting that inside Bitcoin to begin with? And by the way, why does that even need to be decentralized? Maybe it doesn't in the same way. And so to me, we're going to have many different verticals. Like the value of blockchain technology for me is being a sort of global omni ledger for specific types of assets. It's more about the composability and open access than just decentralization. Sometimes decentralization is good, but not always.
But I think that's kind of the point. Bitcoin is not composable. I think that's kind of my point, you know? Yes. And I think that, I'm not thinking so much about payments, right? It's more about finance, and you can, you know, do, I mean, you can't, that this is why Celsius happened, for example, is that you cannot lend Bitcoin at a particular rate on chain. And so, you know, if we can get that going is what I think is going to be really nice. So one other question before we really get into the topic of the day, which is the SEC, and which is Tether. I want to just talk a little bit about Tether if you can, which is, you know, I think that broadly, I think there has been a big shift both in what is actually happening at Tether and in people's perception over the last 2 years, maybe, I want to say, where, you know, they've pretty much, or they at least appear to have put some of the worst excesses of their past behind them and are now operating in a, you know, at least slightly more trustworthy way, it seems. And so I guess I'm curious just kind of for your take on that process, but also kind of whether you think it's a good thing that the largest stablecoin is effectively unregulated.
Well, so there's a lot to unpack there. I'm going to kind of take that as three questions. We'll come to the regulatory one last. So first one, what do I think is happening with Tether? I think they've basically undergone a transformation of being kind of janky and very like loosey-goosey with managing this whole thing towards getting significantly more professional over about the past 4 years, if we're being totally honest.
And that means something coming from you, just to emphasize for listeners.
Yeah, they've gone from owning a lot of commercial paper, never as bad as the rumors were, but never as good as you would want for a cash preservation vehicle, and all sorts of weirdo investments, to largely owning a pile of T-bills and overnight reverse repo secured by treasuries.
I still believe they were in Evergrande. I still believe that.
I actually don't believe they were, having seen some of their stuff. But on
I'll take your word for it. That's good.
But on the other hand, they were still in some commercial paper they shouldn't have been in. So overall, punchline, it's gone from being something that they had to get lucky to continue to survive, which is not a long-term strategy in financial markets, to something that's actually much more durable. I still think in the current form, my concern is more around the form factor, which is to say, I asked two questions about stablecoins. One, do I trust it right now? And I would tell you my answer for Tether is actually, yeah, I think right now they've got all the money. But the other one is, if I don't pay attention to it and come back 2 years later, do I trust the guardrails are there such that I know we're good? And in the case of Tether, the answer there is transparently no, because they don't live within that kind of framework. You know, contra like USDP, where literally there will be somebody at Paxos who goes to jail if they YOLO that whole thing into Tesla stock. That's not true of Tether.
Right, yeah.
And so that to me is a big difference.
And for a little context there, I mean, it's significant because, I mean, there's seems like a growing consensus that there will be at least some kind of recession this year. And that's when you start having to look at the assets underlying, so.
Yeah, Tether, having grown up in a zero rates environment where we didn't have large downturns other than COVID, which they dodged, like, has turned out to be very lucky for them, right? Had Tether launched in the 90s, they probably would have gotten wrecked early with all the interest rate fall there. So the last point on, do I think it's a good thing that the largest stablecoin is offshore? I mean, in an ideal world, you would hope that wouldn't happen. That is something that for the U.S. dollar to be primarily controlled offshore by non-US entities is not the way you would want things to go. But I will say, maybe a little bit of a contrary opinion, I do think it's a good thing in that it's probably taught US regulators these things are here to stay. And your whole idea of like doing Operation Choke Point 2.0 and we'll get rid of them and stablecoins will go away and crypto is just a fad, like that's all wrong. It's wrong. And you need to grapple with these things and come up with a real plan. Otherwise, just like the euro dollar market back in the day, you're going to have a whole market grow and be out of your control. And then eventually you're going to have to deal with the issues of that market because they impact the dollar. But instead of the dog, you're the tail.
Yeah. This is a point Nick Carter has made, is that Tether is basically euro dollars 2.0, which is, and I think that I don't even, I don't know if anybody even knows where they're actually based, but whoever, you know, actually has that leverage.
It appears to be the parent entity appears to be a British Virgin Islands company. Okay. And they seem to be operating largely out of the Bahamas now. But the reality is it's easy to move an unregulated thing around much more than a regulated thing.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. So it's going to be tough when that come to Jesus moment actually happens. With apologies, to find some way to pin them down. That's going to be interesting.
Maybe. I mean, so here's the counterpoint of good regulation. Really good regulation doesn't try to regulate things you can't control. It tries to regulate things you can control. So like if I were in charge of like McHenry's stablecoin bill, one of the things that I would put in there is very simply, if I want to solve this problem, if you want to use a stablecoin for commerce or call it a stablecoin in the United States or to U.S. persons, you have to register and follow these rules, or you need to be in a regime we give equivalency to. And then you just do that and you walk away. Because do you know what that means? Coinbase has to deplatform Tether. All the U.S. market making firms have to deplatform Tether. Nobody can use Tether for payments in the United States. Nobody who's touching the U.S. can use Tether for payments. Or Tether has to come register. Right. We use the weight of the U.S. economy as a carrot rather than a stick to force somebody to act.
Yeah. And you actually bring up an amazing point, which is like, why haven't they done that? Because they're preoccupied with other much less effective approaches, it seems like. So this might be a good time to transition to the fun stuff that we get to talk about, which, you know, I guess we can just loosely invoke the names of Elizabeth Warren and Gary Gensler. And you know, I mean, Jamie Dimon, too, we can talk about a little bit at least. And I guess like to frame it a little bit for listeners who might or might not have been paying attention, I think my characterization would be that there has been a lot of, frankly, political theater about crypto over the last 2 years. Having to do with getting certain people in front of Congress and public statements by Jamie Dimon and others, that does seem, I mean, and this, I guess, is maybe my first question, is this all seems so coordinated and so tactical. And I wonder, you know, I think that there are certain things where it's actually less conspiratorial than you might think. For example, the fact that Prometheum, which we'll talk about, went in front of the House is at the SEC's recommendation is kind of normal, even if it looks sketchy from the outside. And so, yeah, I mean, I guess maybe that's my first question for you is like, I mean, how nefarious is this in its structure, even if we believe that people are like, think that they're doing the right thing, right? Like maybe Gary Gensler and Elizabeth Warren really think they're saving the world by this approach to crypto, but then like, are they playing it above board in their actual tactics, do you think?
Yeah, so those are two different questions, right?
Like, right,
so
I'm leaving the first question aside. Let's assume good intentions.
And probably mixed intentions. Like to steel man the SEC's position here for a moment, I think they could viably say, one, there have definitely been a lot of scams and a lot of fraud in the crypto space, and that looks like a really big problem. And by the way, if you think that stuff is not a security, where the hell has the DOJ been on all of these things? Because they've been sitting on their hands for like half a decade now. So we feel compelled to step in to do something because nobody else is. And our job is to protect consumers. Two, they probably have a point that at least some of these activities are securities like in form and we're not registered. I'm not saying all. But there are at least some tokens that me a pretty neutral person look at it and I'm like, nah, that should have registered.
Which they could have had some easy dubs, which is the mysterious part of all this.
And three, I think they would complain that a lot of VCs and others in the space essentially ginned up a whole lot of interest and then dumped tokens on retail without being transparent about what they were doing. Mm-hmm. And again, all of those I would say are true. Right. So let's concede that to the SEC right at the outset. The problem with their approach and where
is that they're suing Coinbase.
Well, before we even get to Coinbase, the problem with their approach is assuming all of those things are true and you have good intentions, their execution has been so bad, you can only say either you are grossly incompetent or you are criminal. Right. Because before we get to Coinbase, let's talk about DebtBox.
Yes.
Right. So DebtBox, I'm not going to say it's a good company.
No, I looked at it. It looks like a Ponzi, let's be frank.
It may be. I'm going to say I haven't done enough digging to even have a deeply informed opinion on that. And it very well could be that some of the initial allegations have truth or not. So, like, not taking a position on that. What I am going to take a position on is that it is, as a general statement, a bad idea to commit perjury in a federal courtroom to get a TRO. And that is what the SEC did in that case. So, like, you cannot claim to be the good guy when you are doing that stuff. That's a little bit like, well, I found this sketchy business. It may be a front for money laundering. So I went to the guy's house and planted a shitload of fentanyl in his car so we can arrest him. It's like, wait, what?
Busting a suspect. That's right. All you're doing.
And so when you look at things like DebtBox, where, by the way, here's the real egregiousness of it. They lied to the judge. They knew they lied and they didn't go and correct themselves. At least if they had immediately gone and corrected themselves, I would have been like, well, okay, that's bad, but at least they tried it. They just sat on it, right? And without some very good lawyering on the other side, they would not have been called out for that. So when your conduct starts with, yeah, we lie in federal court, I find it hard to take you seriously as the good guy. Two, a lot of their legal theories have catastrophic implications for the regular economy. And I think their crusade to quote unquote get crypto has made them oblivious to the collateral damage. So like the whole back and forth with Gensler and Richie Torres, where Torres was asking him in a hearing, are Pokemon cards securities? And Gary's like, no. And Richie's like, well, what if you tokenize them? And Gary's like, well, maybe. Like, Gary, there is no sane theory that says, well, if I change my back-end accounting software, something goes from being a non-security to a security. That's not how it works. Yeah. And so by tilting at these things and trying to come up with these incredibly expansive theories of what a security is, what they've really done, and this is where I'm worried and where Americans in general should be worried, is opened a Pandora's box for whoever the next SEC chair is. Because you know what's going to happen? Say Trump or somebody far to the right of Trump wins and comes in and is like, well, now we want to use this same playbook. We're going to go use it against, what's an interesting target? How about public sector unions? Because to me, it seems like you are collecting money from others with the expectation that they're going to experience gains from the, like, it's just become so amorphous, you're going to be able to at least target whatever you want. And that's dangerous.
I haven't heard that labor comparison before, and that's incredible. That's like, that's you know, the Pokemon thing is one thing, but when you start talking about like membership organizations being a security, then you're really talking about screwing things up in a major way.
How about royalties on songs, right? Like you start getting into really weird territory when you say, well, you don't need a contract or even a direct relationship, just buying a thing because you think people will be involved in an ecosystem and create value.
Right.
So like used car salesmen or securities dealers, right? Like guys, stop.
Right. Yeah. Like what is a road? You know, it's a security apparently.
but that to me, that is where a lot of my bigger problems with the SEC are around sort of the procedural issues that they are creating by pursuing this. So like great example, suing Coinbase, right? Which you brought up earlier. The thing I find most odious about suing Coinbase is that you had a list of tokens that you are alleging are securities. Do you know what they never did? Enforce against any of those issuers.
Any of them.
They're just trying to backdoor it in through Coinbase without these people getting to represent themselves, which could be, by the way, massively value destroying for the people who bought those tokens. So it's a little bit like to protect the village, we bombed the village.
Does that become like a specific precedent for those tokens then that you can go back and say like this judge ruled against Coinbase, therefore you Filecoin are a security and are going to jail?
It would depend on the nature of the ruling, but that's certainly what the SEC is trying to achieve in this case. Yes.
Yeah. Wow. So what about, you know, and I think maybe this is a more subtle question, but you know, I think that Elizabeth Warren, despite her background in, to some degree, being familiar with finance, I think has less reasonable expectation of knowing what she's talking about on these topics. And so I guess I kind of wonder, and, you know, we'll get back to the SEC, but it's on a different topic. What do you make of the kind of emotional opposition to crypto that's less about like regulation and more about this is evil or something? And I guess another topic that came up was, and related to Warren, was the Wall Street Journal's reporting about terrorist financing, which has also been now completely debunked and to my knowledge has not been retracted. So there's this, I mean, it's like a hysteria. And so I guess maybe I'm curious about your take on the hysteria aspect of this. I probably shouldn't use that word. It's rather gendered, but I can't think of a better one off the top of my head.
Well, I think we've just applied it to a lot of people of both genders, so maybe it still works. So I would say I think there's two parts to it. One is that when your starting assumption is that something is bad, it makes you believe that all of the facts that you get exposed to are going to be in the worst light possible, right? Yeah. So like if you see, well, there's a wallet that had 160 million of money and Hamas had money go through it, you just assume all 160 million is right. Hamas and you don't ask questions.
Which is what the Wall Street Journal did.
Right, which I would suggest is it's motivated reasoning. It's insufficiently critical. But this is the kind of thing people do all the time, right? If you look across the American political spectrum, right, you can see on both sides, like there are Democrats who will assume anybody who owns a gun is a criminal. And Republicans who will assume that anybody who is an illegal immigrant or maybe even just an immigrant is a criminal, right? It's like none of these things are true. That's crazy. Right. But all of them will engage in that reasoning. So one, I think that's a little bit of the same process going on here. Because crypto is bad, starting point, therefore, right, becomes sort of how they interpret all of it.
Therefore, terrorists must use it.
Correct. It becomes a form of religious belief, right, in many ways. Two, I would say there's also definitely an element of like status and like threatening the established order and like sort of privileged position of many of these people.
Yeah.
And what that means is like if you're a banker who's used to controlling the system that you operate in and being the centralized person and everybody needs you, somebody decentralizing the payment system is terrifying because you're going to lose your job, your company is worth nothing. Like, so it a lot of people won't want to admit this, but people react much more strongly to things that threaten their status and money than things that don't. So, you know, to some extent, there's this saying, if you're taking flak, you're over the target. And I think there's definitely an element of that going on. I think these things combined getting into politics is a lot of what's produced the opposition. And then, to be honest, there's a third element, which is that
there's actually a lot of fraud.
Well, yeah, I was going to say the greatest enemy of crypto is typically also crypto. Like, right. You couldn't have a more bombastic, like, jackass-filled, like, incredibly useless group of people to deal with from a political perspective than the crypto community, right? Where you go in there and you want to have a normal discussion about, hey, so most of this money was not Hamas, but a little bit was. And we know that.
Right.
And the intelligence firms, like my friends over at Inca Digital, have the receipts. You can't go in there and be like, well, I want to start with the position that government should be abolished.
Right.
Right? It's like, could you fucking stop? Like, in many ways, it's just the Libertarian Party all over again, which is to say they will never achieve anything politically because they can't get out of their own way ideologically and live in the real world.
Yeah. You know, I had Mike Dudas on a couple weeks ago, and we were talking about, I think that one thing that is changing on that front is the sort of decline of Bitcoin maximalism, which is really the haven, or maybe not even decline, but just the sequestering of Bitcoin maximalism is enough to get a lot of that sort of ideologically. And I mean, I don't want to just dismiss ideological motivation, right? Because like I'm ideologically motivated by things like, you know, uncensorability, autonomy, privacy. But that kind of like sweeping, frankly, reductive ideological performance, I would almost say, because there's ultimately ideology requires ideas. And I'm not sure that there are really fully formed ideas there. But I think that, you know, maybe this is a question, is the leaders of crypto, so to speak, or the influential people, I don't think they're those libertarians anymore. You know, I mean, maybe I'm being too wide-eyed. Maybe I'm like in my own corner, but and not to say that the leaders aren't libertarian, but to say that like those most reductive people, I mean, you don't, Max Keiser is not going to wind up in front of Congress talking about crypto in 2024 probably. I mean, is that a change that you're seeing or you're
I'd say it's a mixed bag. There are definitely more moderates, so to speak, you know, like myself in the room than there were several years ago. But on the other hand, there's still a very strong and very loud crowd who will fight basically all forms of regulation in this space. And so, you know, the message coming from crypto is still, I would say, very libertarian leaning. You still get a lot of things like, say, take Treasury's latest proposal, right, where they were asking for additional powers to fight terrorism financing and whatnot. You know, everybody should know. I had a Twitter thread taking down the majority of that proposal, so I am not an unconditional supporter of that thing. But there are at least one or two things in there that I don't think are totally crazy. And by the way, regardless of what you think of, like, the niche legality of the argument or not, the fact that it was primarily criminals using Tornado Cash at the end is just a factual statement. Again, people have receipts on that. And so telling Treasury, well, because somebody published the code, just deal with it, is not an acceptable response. You need to start coming up with, okay, how do we deal with it, right? And one of the things where I think crypto still has this problem and shoots themselves in the foot is they never go to that second step. Right. Like if you're saying, well, I don't think you should be able to sanction Tornado Cash. OK, but you could see that a lot of crime was happening through it. So how would you stop that? When their answer is that's not my problem, it's just not a credible stance. Like you just get excommunicated from the room and you're not part of the discussion. In many ways, this is very similar to like the libertarian issues with the Patriot Act, whereby not understanding what was going on and not playing ball, you get something much worse than if you had been in the room and help worked on it.
Yeah, and this is where maybe I get backed into the corner of being more of an ideologue, because my response to the Tornado Cash thing a lot of the time, or parallel issues, is like, learn how to do police work, you know, like learn how to investigate crimes without having a surveillance system in place. But, you know, I mean, I guess realistically, which like, I guess my job as a as an opinion columnist is to yell the simple thing sometimes. But you're making a good point about tactics.
Well, let me pause you there and say why I would be worried about giving that as a rejoinder. Okay, so you say that to somebody who's a smart person working in intelligence. And what they'll do is go say, okay, well, now I got to do a ton of legwork. And they figure out, okay, these are North Korean wallets working through offshore exchanges. We don't totally know how they get their money there. I can't predict it in advance. I can't interdict it. So if I want to stop the money from going there, I have to ban U.S. companies from dealing with pseudonymous people, period, full stop. You may end up somewhere much worse.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we already have a version of that, right?
Yeah, but we have a small version of that. You do not want like the Jones Act, but for crypto, where if it's not like manufactured in the U.S. or mined by a U.S. Bitcoin miner, it's verboten, right?
Right.
So I would just tell people, be cautious about what you are asking for. Really think that through with experts, because they may actually have current tools that will solve the problems. They just do a shitload of collateral damage, and that's why they haven't deployed them yet.
Interesting. Yeah. And that's a good point. And I mean, I would also say that I guess like the other thing that I'm hopeful about is that people who are familiar with these systems can come up with new approaches that are fit for purpose and that are not just like stamping something from another category onto this new thing.
Correct. But they need to actually participate, like responding to legitimate concerns about terrorism financing with, we don't want to build a system that gives the government any power, will be correctly interpreted by the government as an attempt to overthrow the government.
So what is the positive agenda here, right? Like what do you support the McHenry bill? Is that your best version that's extant right now of what crypto regulation would look like? And maybe we talk about some, you know, high level details.
Yeah. So let me start with the first principles statement on that one, which is, I think the rules that should apply to tokens that are real world assets, and what I mean by real world assets is tokenizing things that exist in our actual world and then putting them on a blockchain, should probably be very different than the rules that apply to just the blockchain.
Great place to start.
So what I'm about to say when I'm speaking about stablecoins does not generalize to like Bitcoin, to be clear.
Yeah.
But I would say for that in particular, I think the McHenry bill is a very good starting point. US dollar stablecoins, narrowly reserved, with supervision, bankruptcy remote, doesn't have to be a bank, which is very important. There are all sorts of reasons you might not want just banks doing this, and probably needs freeze and seize capability and like very good transparency. Like that's a good framework that will largely protect consumers and make these things work properly. There are some nits to figure out, like at what level should there be federal supervision? Because it shouldn't be 100%. Like the Federal Reserve should not be spending its money on the $2.5 million US dollar stablecoin experiment from GMO. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, Alaska should not be running $1 trillion stablecoin with no federal oversight. So there's a barrier in there somewhere. Mm-hmm. But no, I think that's one part. Yeah. I think then you also need to figure out what parts of the BSA work, what parts don't work, because there is a lot of garbage in there. How do we port that onto a blockchain and have an important bill for that? And then I think you need some form of market structure bill. I put that one last because I think it is the most complicated. There's a lot going on there that the other two don't have to grapple with. Mm-hmm.
Although I think the details are escaping me right now, but we've had some advances on the custodianship regulation side recently.
So let's go back to the SEC. A lot of that is blocked by SAB 121. I have said in many ways, the SEC's rules about custody caused FTX.
Yeah.
Right. Like one of the causal factors in FTX being so big and blowing up so many people was the SEC banning regulated custodians from doing transparent custody. Because if you had instead embraced that and required it, FTX couldn't have happened. People would have known they were playing games with the money.
Is it 121 or 128?
Yeah, it's Staff Accounting Bulletin 121, where what the SEC basically said, and this is not like custody in any other space, said if you do crypto custody for customers, you have to put that all on your own balance sheet like it is your own assets.
Which means you then have to have additional capital, correct?
Correct. It also, like, one, the capital consequences of that are catastrophic. It basically means they need to charge you infinity dollars to do custody. So it is essentially a backdoor ban. Two, I would point out assets on the balance sheet of a custodian are the property of the custodian. They are not bankruptcy remote. So there's a very good chance that the SEC also causes a Celsius type situation with that, with a custodian that people thought was bankruptcy remote. So it is like, if I were being paid by banks to cripple crypto, I wouldn't be doing anything differently than what the SEC is currently doing, which tells you how bad their strategy is.
Yeah. I want to talk about Gary Gensler specifically and not personally in the most hostile sense, but I mean, I think that there are a couple of things that are fascinating about him. One is that obviously he was, I believe, at MIT teaching crypto courses before he came on as SEC chair and has actually in the past said positive things about crypto. Second, he is well known to be ambitious. And for a long time, there were discussions about people saying he wanted to be head of the Treasury. And that, I guess I'll get ahead of the question here and say that seems unlikely at this point. But I guess I'm curious how much his personal motivations have shaped his agenda and how you think that's working out for him.
So it's interesting for me when people in crypto talk about Gensler's time at MIT, because I think the more relevant time was Gensler was the chair of the CFTC from what, 2019 to 2014, if I'm remembering correctly. And he had a reputation for extreme hardball gangster style behavior there, bending the rules, riding the staff really hard.
Never heard this before.
Basically, by the end, he was reviled and people did not like it. But this is some like TradFi inside baseball. Yeah. So his reputation of behaving like this as a regulator predates the SEC. This comes from the CFTC. And so to me, the idea that Gensler was going to change his spots like midstream and suddenly behave like a magnanimous person at the SEC when he'd been the definition of a jerk at the CFTC and quite frankly broken a lot of stuff was a little surprising. I would just tell you, to me, this is Gary being Gary. Like, I think Gary wants to be right. He wants to win. He doesn't care about collateral damage. He is very ambitious, but like, if you look at his CFTC behavior, it's important to remember Gary is not a lawyer, right? He's in here to achieve his goals and isn't afraid to break a few eggs to make an omelet, so to speak. The problem is when those eggs you're breaking are the U.S. economy, you maybe should think twice.
Yeah. And I guess, again, to get a TradFi perspective, I think that, and I probably fall victim to this myself, being, you know, sort of a crypto insider, people frankly spike the ball quite enthusiastically every time he stumbles. And I guess I'm curious whether that perception holds up from the outside, because he does seem to have taken some really tremendous L's. And you know, does it really seem like that his ambitions are going to end here? I just saw somebody at DeFi Llama saying that their prediction is that he's going to step down this year, which, I mean, I guess it, depending on the timing of the election, who knows? But it doesn't seem like he's actually going to like concede that he's lost or anything like that.
So 2 years ago, I would have told you no. I think he's started to take enough L's on the TradFi side that it's becoming a problem for him now, right? Which is to say, the whole fiasco with the Bitcoin ETFs and now what a big success it's been and how that only happened after a lawsuit has not won Gary any friends in the entire asset management community. That is a big problem if you were the SEC chair.
In the sense that they're seeing that they could have been making money?
Yes. TradFi firms are now like, oh, so you cost us a ton of profits managing Bitcoin ETFs for no good reason for like four years. Yeah. So like, no. That's one problem. Number two, that whole custody fiasco, as much as that has bad outcomes for crypto, man, the way they're trying to rewrite the qualified custodian rule just breaks the entire alt space, right? Like you're saying, well, you need a qualified nationally regulated bank custodian to hold things through an RIA, but RIA is being like, yo, we do things like art and rare cars. Like what? Like, have you guys, do you even know what we do as a job? Right. And so like when TradFi people look at that stuff and are like, do these guys know what they're talking about? Like, that is not the response that you want. And then lastly, just the crypto custody thing. Like, you blocked Boney Mellon and State Street. There's going to be repercussions for that. Yeah. So,
well, and lying in court doesn't help either.
Yeah. Gary is making a lot of TradFi enemies now, which is not something that was true several years ago. The SEC has just gotten massively out over their skis. And to be honest with you, I'm starting to see political consensus forming for them to be dramatically restructured or reformed. Wow. And I think that's how it, like, when an agency goes this rogue to the point that the industry they regulate starts raising their hand and being like, yeah, we're not cool with this. At some point, you've got to do something, because like, hey, we'll just put a new guy in and it'll be fine is not a credible answer once it's been so procedural.
Yeah. So I do have one other topic to get to on this, and then we'll start winding down, which is Prometheum, which is the quote unquote registered crypto exchange that might actually exist at some point in the semi near future, but that was essentially used as a, again, a bit of theater by the SEC put in front of the House, and was telling people that there was no need for additional crypto regulation, kind of echoing the Gary Gensler, Elizabeth Warren line that that current regulation covers all this stuff and it's an illegal security. Now we have them saying that they have, and you might be able to get the details more correct than I am, but they have an approval to begin trading Ethereum. They have their all their licenses worked out, and that seems to be on the way, except that this now, because of the way that they've been talking about it, that implies that they believe Ethereum is a security and that their regulators agree, which has other implications. So I'm just curious for, I guess, maybe your most powerful impressions of that situation. Like, what do you think is the really important thing there? Because, again, it's easy to get sucked into conspiracy theory when what's going on is, I like to say, probably way stupider than that.
Yeah, so I would say this is where you can tell the SEC doesn't really understand the technology or what's going on. Like, one of the things you'll hear frequently from people who are crypto skeptics and no coiners is same activity, same rules. And they will remain nameless, but I once said to an SEC staffer, okay, cool. So what are the rules for me to go down the street to Schwab, where I have a brokerage account, and take all of my securities that I have in my Schwab account into my self-custodial wallet? And they're just like, what? And I'm like, it's not the same activity, right? Yeah. There are fundamentally different things going on here. So one of the things you need to think about with securities trading is the ecosystem around that. So normally when you're trading, there's a broker dealer, which faces the client, the broker dealer faces the exchange, and then the exchange has a clearing agent. And often there's a custodian involved there as well. Mm-hmm. Okay, so problem number one, blockchains essentially do automated clearing on the blockchain. What a clearing agent is in blockchain world is kind of like, what? right? So that is a problem, number one. There is no crypto-registered clearing agent with the SEC. So I don't understand mechanically how you're going to trade this.
So we know, just so people know what we're talking about, help me out. The big stock clearing agency is called what?
DTCC. Depository Trust Corporation. And so what they do is when you buy a stock, you've got to give cash and get the stock certificates. And they manage that whole procedure on the back end. And everything clears actually like 2 days after you do it. That's what T+2 is. So it's kind of a mess, right? That's classic like TradFi, like tape and bubblegum holding this thing together. But on the back end, you have people literally like moving these things around either manually or in a database. Obviously, a blockchain automates all of that. So it leaves a real question as to like, what roles are we talking about? What does custodian mean? What does clearing agent mean? And the SEC not having provided any guidance or licensed any of these things makes me look at Prometheum and be like, congratulations, you have a one-legged, four-legged table, right? So like, even if you have your broker-dealer license, right? Okay, maybe you do, but like, where's the rest, guys? So for them to begin trading Ethereum, I would like to know between whom and in what way, because you have many of these other like structural problems.
Right.
It just, let me put it this way. Prometheum seems like the kind of business you would come up with if you asked a lawyer to narrowly define what I am allowed to do with the current guidance of the SEC without stopping and asking that lawyer. And by the way, it needs to actually work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and that's literally, I mean, they're literally a family of lawyers, I believe. Yeah. So that totally makes sense. But on the, you know, on the tactical side, right, like Prometheum also does actually have quite a few SEC and other former regulators that are in various positions or have been in the past. I don't know what the current thing is. So, I mean, is that just kind of that talent was attracted by the premise that we're going to do the regulated exchange or what?
Yeah, I mean, so again, I think people like there's some grand conspiracy theory here is less true than it's more like, hey, these are people who know how the SEC thinks. And the only path the SEC would be okay with for crypto is basically stop doing crypto, like no public distribution, no self-custody, like it all needs to live at DTC and be in custody there, you clear it the regular way. So we're going to build a thing that does that, right? Which to me is like an incredibly tech regressive viewpoint. It's a little bit like saying, well, you built the automobile, but it doesn't follow the rules. So turn the engine off and pull it with horses.
Yeah, yeah. That seems like a great metaphor for what they're doing.
That's basically what Prometheum is.
Yeah. Well, I think we're getting up against your time to handle other things, but are there, any last important topics that are burning a hole in your pocket and B, just kind of things that you want to point people towards or, plugs?
Well, I was going to say my last important topic, and this feeds back into Prometheum, is the path that's actually going to happen with all this stuff is not like the Ferrari being pulled by horses. It's all this stuff is just going to move offshore. There are other regulators, non-US, who are doing a very good job in this space. Look at the MAS, look at the HKMA, look at the JFSA. Mm. Go have a look over at what's going on in Abu Dhabi and Dubai. Maybe even the EU, depending on how MiCA turns out. The UK is working on stuff. Bermuda has a stablecoin framework, right? So it's going to move. If we don't do it here, it will happen. It will just happen somewhere else. We've already seen this once with semiconductors, right?
Yeah.
And so to me, the number one thing I would say to anybody who's an American is you need to get religion on crypto being allowed. You don't have to like it. You don't have to think it's great. You don't have to think it's perfect. But the idea that just banning it will work will only cause us to play from behind in the future of the financial system. And that's a huge mistake.
Yeah. Yeah, great point. Great point. Well, so what is your, you know, obviously this is impossible to talk about in clear terms, but I mean, very broadly, what would you say is your time horizon for the U.S. getting its act together before that actually happens?
I would tell you by the end of the next administration, right? If we haven't sorted this out by, you know, the end of the next presidential administration, at that point, so much stuff will be built elsewhere that, well, specifically the problem is it's not going to move back. Like, even if we get it right, if all of the big custodians are in Japan and Hong Kong and Singapore and the UK, and like all of the actual issuers are now coming out of either the Middle East or Singapore or something, the problem you run into is a little bit like the euro dollar market. It becomes too late to pull it back in the form it's in. And also, 8 years of extreme crypto skepticism from the US would mean that them trusting the U.S. again will take another decade. So even if you wanted to get them to move back, like it just makes the time frame far too long. So I would say, to me, the biggest L we could take on crypto is essentially the Biden administration and their current crypto policies winning the next election. At that point, I'm going to tell you it's probably too late for us to fix it.
Wow. Well, Austin Campbell, Mike Dudas ended on an upbeat, so you got us on the down. It's a nice match set. Thanks for joining us.
Hold on. I am not, I want to be clear. I don't mean this is a super downbeat thing. I actually think we'll largely get through it and that sanity will prevail here. Yeah. That is just how we'd get it wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. One last question and then we'll wrap up. I mean, what are the things that you're watching closely? I mean, I know you're not like a market guy per se, but what are the things that you're watching closely for the next year?
One, some of the newest blockchains getting really, really good as being a vehicle for fast payments globally, right? The ability to send dollars extremely cheaply globally to settle things like vendor balances, peer-to-peer payments, like regular way corporate activity is incredibly powerful. I'm going to call out two of the S blockchains for that one, and that the ones I'm watching are Solana and Sui in terms of who I think actually has a good shot at that and like what they're doing. The other thing that I am extremely bullish on in the long run is the tokenization of things beyond just dollars. Right. Like one of my favorite little widgets from Paxos was PaxG, which is the gold token. But getting more things titled and tokenized and allowing them to be distributed in a system that's more robust than local is going to be an incredibly human rights improving thing. And I think it's great for the world.
Awesome. Awesome. One last thing that just occurred to me, and I'm sorry, we're going to put a pin in it for a future conversation, which is restaking and rehypothecation as a security model for L2s. We're not going to talk about it now. We're not going to talk about it now, but I do want to know your thoughts on that soon. So we might have to do another one, but where can people find you and what would you like people looking at, et cetera, et cetera?
So you can really only find me on Twitter. I am only grudgingly on social media. You can blame the aforementioned Nick Carter along with my friends Chris Perkins and Omid Malakhan for dragging me on there in the first place. So,
well, you've been a positive contributor, so thanks to them.
Yeah, thank you. At Campbell J. Austin on Twitter. I try not to really like bug people too much other than that, but I was going to say, I guess the other thing is if you, on the off chance you want my help, please feel free to bomb in through the website for the consulting firm. There's a way to contact me there.
Sorry, which is what?
ZeroKnowledge.consulting.
Okay.
In the Twitter bio, though. If you can get to Twitter, you can find me.
Great. Well, Austin, thanks again. It was great to talk to you. We don't do it enough, but hopefully more soon.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. Really enjoyed it.
Really, really cool. Thank you.
The Dark Markets podcast is edited and with production assistance by Eleanor Paul. Music is by Altus Nomina. Writing, hosting, and production, flaws and all, are by me, David Z. Morris. Dark Markets is a listener-supported production. Subscribe at darkmarkets.xyz to receive the Dark Markets newsletter, and consider a premium subscription to get bonus podcast content and full access to early drafts of my book in progress on Sam Bankman-Fried. Thanks for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks.